listening to Listener Supported WUXD Studios.
Everybody, this is Jonathan Bowman. I am your host, and you're listening to Diagram. And today we have a very special guest, Darren Hood. I know that a lot of you guys know him, so there's no need to really get into introductions and all that. But for those of you that don't, you will see that Darren is one of the most profound UX leaders of our time. He brings up some really amazing points. I thought we were going to go down like some path of like negativity and talking about all the not so great things about UX, like the problems we have with recruiting, the problems we have with job descriptions, but that did not happen. In fact, this podcast is very unique because I have to stop a lot of times because Darren has these moments of clarity that are just like mic dropping. So I'll go off and research a little and then kind of come back and add some more context to some of the things he's saying because it's so deep and so rich. So I hope you guys enjoy. Go grab yourself a coffee, get a moleskin and a pencil. You're going to want to write some of these things down that he's talking about. Don't miss it. Stay right here with us. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to the show and welcome, Darren.
How's it going, Jonathan? Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for being on the show. Okay, guys, so I'll get straight to it. There's a lot of ground to cover. We want to talk about all the different issues that we've seen in the design community, in the UX community. But I think we should take a step back because when you talk about issues today, with recruiting, hiring, portfolios, all that sort of stuff, we kind of missed a big chunk of the problem. So Darren, if you would be so kind, tell us where we came from as UX designers. Tell us the beginning of UX, please.
The discipline of UX, as we know it today, began to ramp up in the late 1990s. A lot of people know about the history of Donald Norman being the first person with UX in his job title, and that was the early to mid 1990s, about 1990, approximately 1993. But that practice did not become mainstream for several years after that. The initial group of people who were working in what we now know as UX were made up of mostly information architects. That was the probably the most popular term, and interaction designers. Then when you come to the dot-com bust, which I like to feel like UX actually saved everybody from it, because everybody was rushing to the internet, but people were not, the user was left out in the cold. What were their needs? What were their mental models? What did they need to accomplish? Why in the world would they come to your site? What could you do for them? What was in it for them? This was all being left out. The research wasn't being done. People were coming to websites. It wasn't working. The focus shifted to the user. And that's when things began to take off. But I can't remember the exact year, but I want to say about 2002, 2003, somewhere along in there, you see research that was done by IBM and by NASA, and they began to focus on the impact, the ROI of user experience related work. And they conducted their studies and they found out, they actually came up with two different sets of results, but they were both astronomical. They found that for every dollar that a company invests in user experience, they gain anywhere from $100, and I can't remember, one of the reports was like $200 in return. So you've got this 200 to 250% potential impact. Actually, it was about that. Yeah, 100 to 250, the impact that comes from UX. So this is phenomenal information.
Whoa, wait a minute. Did you guys just hear what he said? That is crazy. Now, we may have all heard this before. We may all think we understand it and we really can wrap our heads around it. But let me shed a little bit of light on what he's talking about. So the IBM independent study, that did happen around the time he said it happened. The NASA study, that did happen around the time that he said it happened. And you got to think, like, historically, like, why did this happen? Like, why was it going on? Well, you know, when you're trying to justify business ROI, you validate your business, right? So this didn't really necessarily come directly from the UX community. This is more of a business approach to saying, why are we hiring these people? How effective are they? It's also an argument tool that you use to be able to go back to people that may have some sort of issues with UX and say, look, there is a way to calculate what we're doing, and there's a way to prove that what we're doing is absolutely effective. So why did you even have to do that? That to me is the ridiculous part. But let's go into a little bit of more recent studies. So I recommend you take a look at McKinsey's study. I'll put the link in the show notes and you can check that out. There's also an Envision one. McKinsey's was done in 2018 and the Envision one is 2019, talking about the maturity models and the ROI of UX. So when you're talking about this to people, you probably want to read up on those too. But it gets a little bit more complex because now that you talk about this, you got to think about, like, what does this mean? What is this high percentage of value and return? Which, by the way, since we're in 2020 now, it's only going to get higher and higher. UX is absolutely the most money-driving tool right now that tech has. Unequivocally, you can't argue that. That's just the truth. And when you say, you know, you're getting this big ROI, how does that happen? So I want to be really clear. It's all about specifics to your company, which is why I'll put a link to a calculator that you can calculate yourself to see what the ROI is where you're at. I also want to be clear that it's not just because you're changing flows or you've rerouted contextual mental models or you spent countless hours figuring out a user journey and you nailed it. All that stuff is important. All those skills are important. And all that you bring to the table is highly important. But that's not really what the findings are showing. That's not really what's happening. What's happening is actually a little bit more complex than that. So, where is the complexity and like, what does it mean exactly? It's the hard and soft skills that UX is bringing to the table that are actually changing the way the organization works. That's where the value is. So it's not, again, it's not that you tweaked the screen and you made the screen look better. That's table stakes. If you can't meet up to the maturing models of people like Apple and Google, you've already lost. You got to have all that basic stuff. It's got to flow and be intuitive. That has to be there. It's actually more so about true UX professionals in the organization leading these changes, these organizational changes that are pretty massive. And that takes a very brave person because that could mean career suicide, essentially. It's hard to go in there and change the way it's done. And that's why I talk about foundational design, because if you start later, it's only your chances of being successful are super low. So that's why when people say, oh, you can go and UX can change an organization, and then you hear people say, no, it can't. Well, they're kind of right. You can hire a third party and they can change their organization, or they can try, and that even that's not guaranteed. So it has to start very early at the beginning, at the impetus of the company, at the impetus of the product and the features. So that's where you see the value. That's how you get the ROI. It comes from the UX professional doing their job with their toolkit, with all these different tools that they have. We understand psychology. We understand taxonomies, ontologies. We understand how to get everybody excited. We understand how to get everyone to change how they're thinking, how to design for behaviors. We understand all these things. So those are the things that are actually moving everyone in the company to get excited about UX to increase the overall ROI. That's not to say that you can't, you know, simplify that statement and say, per UX designer, I'm getting $1 million back. Okay, whatever. That's a little too simple though. It's not the designer. It's the fact that designer is a professional. They know what they have to do. They know their skills. And they're bringing the whole company together in this really cool way that's making everyone go through these processes properly and put yourself through these UX rigors that end up bringing out such a supreme product that you're now capable of attracting the attention of your customers and getting high revenue because they see high value in what you build. Now let's go back to Darren.
All these corporations are getting involved. Actually, it still continues to this day because a lot of companies are just now getting on board with UX, just learning what it is, deciding that, hey, we need UX people. But everybody, the vast majority of companies, even though some companies are getting it right, I don't want to leave out those who are doing well. But the problem is that it doesn't take much to muddy the waters as a whole, which is one of the reasons why I like to call out those things that are critical. We have to deal with that because it grows exponentially and it creates problems exponentially. So we have to take care of, if you have four tires and you have a leak in one tire, your attention must go to the one tire. If you get too excited about the fact that you have three wonderful tires and fantastic rims and great traction and great tread, but you ignore the hole in the fourth tire, your progress will soon end. So you have to, anything that's going to monkey wrench you, you have to pay attention to it. So this is one of the main problems that will sort of, everything that I talk about today will revolve around these. From about 2002, 2003, 2004 till now, the vast majority of corporate, even some of the agencies are getting it wrong today. The vast majority of the corporate structures, they add UX to their repertoire from a personnel perspective, but they don't know what UX is. They don't know what value it brings. They don't know how to work it into their overall structure, strategy, business operation. They don't know how to deal with the people who are holding down the positions for the most part. And so this creates a huge, a really bad conundrum. Everybody says, hey, UX, this is where it's at. And all of these companies keep saying, hey, one of the top 10 up and coming positions is user experience. And ooh, I want to, and then people put out these salary reports that talk about what these starting salaries are. So that created a problem too. Now you've got this from about 2010 forward, this massive influx for the last decade. People trying to get, it's really more, not so much 2010, more like 2013. Dr. Fine mentioned this, and I agree. It's about 2013, 2014. All these people go, hey, UX, ooh. And so then you have the corporations already, we're already at 2014, we're still in a grossly, as a discipline, a grossly immature state. Now you've got this massive, I mean, Gold Rush was the perfect way to describe it, because everybody wants to run out to the West to get some of that fire gold. And so people are rushing into UX to get some of that fire gold.
Oh my gosh.
Just as the corporations didn't find out what was going on, a lot of the people trying to get into UX didn't find out what was going on. So now we've got this terrible pot of soup, I like to call it, because the ingredients are you got some good ingredients. You know, hey, let's put some tomatoes in there, and let's put some green peppers in there. We're going to have this nice big goulash going. And hey, let's put a mud pie in there. No, we don't need that. Caterpillar in there. You know, this is what we've got.
Whether we like it or not,
this is what we're faced with today.
Yeah, we're faced with it today, but we can't let it go into tomorrow. So I really need to hear from you. What do we do to fix it? This is crazy. Like, what can we do?
Well, the first thing is, and I'll pick up right where I was. Corporations don't understand what's going on average. And the chances of you and I trying to find an opportunity, and I'm just using us generically. So Person X is trying to find an opportunity in UX. And I don't care how much experience you have. You've got a problem trying to find the right thing. The companies, Company X, the average one, doesn't know what's going on. So their ability to hire in an optimal fashion is tainted at best, on average. And that's putting it mildly. So we start there to resolve the issue. Companies carry the torch. Even though UX professionals, we could do better to standardize, we could do better to have more agreement among us as to what good UX really is and what a good practice is. Again, referencing that talk the other day, they have standards in accountants with accounting, they have standards in the medical profession, they even have standards automotive mechanics, for God's sake. I mean, you just go through
right. Our
professional landscape and establish mature, there's your keyword, establish mature disciplines have standards. And people adhere to those standards. Those gold standards are what everybody, the practices, the people in the practices, are what they're measured by. That's what a lot of education is one of the topics we're going to cover today. Education understands what those gold standards are and they established curriculums and programs to mirror those standards that have been agreed upon. We cannot achieve that from a U.S. Right. standpoint because we're not mature and we're not really moving toward maturity. Matter of fact, today, 2020, we're moving away from maturity. We're becoming more immature. We're going backwards.
And that's right.
Due to that problem I mentioned, because the gold rush, the people who are coming in, many of them, some of them are fresh in. They're genuinely, got to give a shout out to the people who genuinely want to get involved in UX, would like a career in UX, are getting educated, doing the right things, and all education is not created equal. Hope you get a chance to talk about that too. But then you've also got a bunch of people that are coming in and they don't. Everybody who went west to get gold wasn't legit.
Okay, I have to stop again. And I'll also explain a little bit of why I'm stopping so much. One, Darren is saying some amazing things. Two, and no disrespect to the listeners, a lot of it might be over your head, especially if you're a younger UXer. But the third reason is technical issues. As you know, we can't necessarily bring people into the studio because of the current situation. So we have to do a lot of Zoom calls over the phone. So that kind of gets in the way with our audio quality. So some of these things I kind of want to bring context to, but also that gives me opportunity to overdub on some of the staticky convos and bring a little bit more clarity. But back to what Darren just said and the bomb he just dropped. Did you guys hear that? He said people coming in. Actually, let's summarize before I go into that last statement. He's outlining like in a linear timeline what's going on and how we got to where we are today. So he told you we really kind of originated from information architects, which is where my background. And interaction designers. Those are the two things that I'm really good at and that I love to do. So, and he's absolutely right. That's where it all kind of kicked off. I agree. I'm a part of his generation, so I was a part of that time too. But then he talks about how there was a way to prove that the work we did was extremely valuable. And then I'm going to add a link to his other podcast talking about this concept of a gold rush, but that's a very good analogy because what he's saying is so many people decided to get into the field that they flooded it, and they flooded it without having that background and without at least understanding those primary core disciplines that you should have. That's scary. That's really uncool. And that's why we're here today. I even brought up some stuff offline with Darren about when I look for hiring folks and I look at portfolios, which by the way, I don't believe in portfolios. If you're going to look at them, that's great. But this is why I don't believe in them, because what he just said is absolutely true. I've seen portfolio after portfolio, and these people that were applying for jobs use the same use case. So somewhere in their educational path, I don't know if it's where it happens, but at some place, they've either been told, like amongst themselves, to do this. They've probably been told by maybe a college or wherever they're getting their certification to do this. Maybe they were prompted, I don't know, maybe they're prompted by recruiters, I don't know. I don't know who's telling them to do this, but when you copy the same exact use case and you put it in your portfolio, that's fraud. So that's why, like, I don't even look at them. I do a lot of other sort of more methodical research about the person before I even look at a portfolio. Do I need to know? Do you need to wow me? No. I need to see where you've worked. I need to talk to who's worked with you. I need to see a track record. And then there's just a lot of EQ specific things that you have to have that help you pick up on, you know, is this person a good hire? And we'll do a show on that too. But he just dropped the bomb right there. Like, that's crazy, but it's so true. And I've seen it. There are a lot of folks that have flooded the industry that have no clue what they're doing. Now, if this is where you're at today, that's totally okay. We were all there. We all had to start somewhere. What's not okay is stealing someone else's work, reusing case studies. This is actually a testament to the fact that the whole portfolio thing is ridiculous. I mean, would you have to copy and paste or reuse case studies if creating them wasn't ridiculous anyhow? How much time do you have when you're working at another job to sit there and build something for free? So I understand the struggle there. I totally get that. That's an entirely different topic. And we'll bring it up in a later show. But if you need help, if you're brand new and you're trying to figure out, like, where do I go from here? I don't know what I'm doing. I want to break into the field. Go for it. I totally encourage you. Do not steal. Do not commit fraud. Do not act like you know what you're talking about. There are specific sets of skills that you absolutely have to have just to be a bottom of the barrel basic UX designer. And if you don't have those, don't even try, because you might get a job somewhere. You might, you know, be able to function at a company somewhere, but you're not actually doing the job of a true UX professional. So you're tricking yourself, and eventually, if you want to succeed in Excel, you're going to have to push yourself to learn these skills. And all it's doing is messing up the community in a way where we are now not looked at like the professionals that we should be looked at as. So if you need me, hit me up. I can help you. I can put you on the right path and guide you. Find me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at UXDJB. Send me a message. I'll be happy to guide you through some of the skills that you need. Again, not portfolio stuff. That's fluff. Those are things to wow people. Maybe recruiters like to see cool moving animations and crazy looking UIs and all that. I don't care about that. I care about your skills and your competencies. If I needed you to get something done in an hour, could I rely on you? Do you have the skills to know how to change your fidelity to quickly knock things out and get it done? Those are the things I care about. And those are things that big companies care about when they're trying to hire UX professionals. If they don't, you're probably not in a UX position. All right, so let's get back to Darren. Okay, Darren, so we have recruiters listening. We have engineers that might be interviewing potential candidates for UX positions. We obviously have UX designers listening. We all want to know, what are your four pillars, or what I like to call like the core competencies of UX? Let's have you break that down for us, because your school of thought is right in line with my school of thought. I totally agree with this. So tell us your four pillars.
Four pillars. Usability, which I like to group, even though heuristics, many people say heuristics is a part of research, I group heuristics with usability, because they're too closely dependent and too closely related in their inner structure. So usability and heuristics are one pillar. The second one, which is where most of us started, information architecture, which is at the core of every single solitary user experience, revolving around your taxonomies, your nomenclatures, and establishing of information sense, S-E-N-T. How well are you helping people to find things? Number three, research, UX research, which some people mention, and they mention it as if it's this small operation. There are at least 15 to 18 different types of research that you could conduct to help support your user experience practice. It will be based on what your capabilities are, and it will vary based on what your organization or your project need to go forward. So when somebody says they want to do research and they make a generic statement, you really need to find out what you're really saying and what your needs really are, because is it going to be ethnography? Research is not just remote usability testing. It's not just card sorting. It's not just firing up something and doing tree testing. That's not it. It's not. And it's funny because that one, tree testing, is related to information architecture. We were talking the other day about how information architecture is almost dropped off the radar completely.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I got to play that again because I don't think you guys understand the gravity of what he just said. So let's hear that one more time.
Information architecture is almost dropped off the radar completely.
Okay. So I got to say, I was extremely shocked to hear this. But then I thought about it for a little bit and realized if there's anybody who's come across this kind of ridiculousness, it's Darren. Because he sees people from all over the world. He talks to people from all over the world. He's a pretty prominent UXer, and it makes sense. And then I got to also thinking about my own experience, and I've been extremely fortunate. I've been in a sort of Silicon Valley bubble. So that is something I've never seen except for very recently. And not only was it shocking, but I could not even stomach it. Dealing with people that don't have that basic core skill set, it really kind of kills your day-to-day productivity, because it's like talking to someone who doesn't even speak your same language. So it's not effective, it's not efficient in the workplace. And if you lack that skill, reach out to me. I'll be happy to run you through a class and get you up to speed on information architecture. Let's go back to Darren, because he tells us about a really important book that you should pick up called Information Foraging Theory.
There's a book that I have on my bookshelf right outside of my office where I am. Called Information Foraging Theory. And through that book, I learned that studies proved that people, their search for information is identical to animals foraging for food, which is where the concept of information sets came from. So information architecture, and then it actually borders on that fourth pillar of interaction and interface design.
Okay, let's stop here and review quickly. Remember that moleskin I told you to get and your pencil, whatever you use? Let's write these down. Number one, usability. Obviously, you should know that, right? Number two, information architecture. If you do not know this, I will roll up my moleskin and bop you in the head, because you gotta know this. Number three, research. It doesn't mean that you're a researcher. It just means you understand the different methodologies. You understand how to extract insights. And number four, interface design and interaction design. Pretty simple. You gotta know them. If you don't, give me a call. I'll help you. All right, let's get back to Darren. Okay, so we talked about the skills that you need, but how do you kind of counter vet that against the jobs that you're applying for?
Look at the postings. Look and see what people are requiring from a skill and a responsibilities perspective. Learn how to judge those so you learn what not to apply for. If you see a job posting for a UX professional and they're telling you that they want somebody to do 10 and 15 different things, they're looking for a unicorn.
Yeah, hold on. Let me stop you right there, because there are a lot of folks right now that are listening that are jobless. This is the reality we live in. We're living in a reality right now where these folks who know what they're doing, who can live by these four pillars you just outlined, and they understand UX and they're true UX professionals, and they don't have jobs. So what are these things they should be looking out for? Because our jobs should be to help them out and to guide them in the right direction. Do you have any hard, fast rules on any buzzwords or red flags to avoid out there?
If you see UX UI, I'm not saying don't apply. There is no such thing as UX UI. So if you see that, that lets you know that there's a lack of UX maturity in that organization. It does not mean that you should not apply for the position, but just be ready to discuss at length what your responsibilities truly will be. Because a lot of people think that UX just makes things look better. That's not what we do. As you can probably see when I mentioned those four pillars, it's not about making things look good. Somebody else takes care of that. The interface designer, the person who does the visual design work, takes care of that. We make sure the skeleton is solid and sound. We make sure the structure is appropriate. We make sure that the structure, it's like an architect in the world, makes sure that everything is laid out properly so that the construction company can come in and build that building properly, and then everything is up to code. We do the same thing. That's why a lot of us are still to this day called UX architects, because we're doing the same thing. We're the undertow people. So make sure that you vet out what you see on a job position before you even apply. And then make sure that you earmark what questions you need to answer to verify where that company is coming from. You need to see how mature they are as an organization. You want to see how mature they are in their UX hiring, because if they're sketchy in their hiring, they're going to be sketchy in the way that they manage you when you get on board too. If they are not businesslike in the way that they deal with you as a candidate, they're not going to be businesslike when you get in there and get hired. And those of you who know me, you look at my profile, man, Darren, he sure does know a lot, but how's he been to so many places? Why has he worked so many places? Because I have been bad in the past at judging bad situations, but I'm not, I have realized, hey, this is a bad situation. This is not what they sold me on. And I need to get out, and I have to take the risk of looking bad because I have so many places on my resume, because it's better than staying here and dying. Not only are they interviewing you, you are interviewing them. So to come into an interview, your interview, can you imagine if you came into an interview and they didn't have any questions? The interview starts and they just sit there and look at you. You would think something was wrong, wouldn't you? Matter of fact, you know something's wrong. So take that principle. If they're interviewing you, they come in prepared. They have questions. They have a script. Where's your script? If you're interviewing them, yeah, you should have questions. When you go through that job posting, start logging your questions. I have a practice that I'll recommend to people too. Take a job posting. I take the job. I'll just tell you exactly what I've done. Take the job posting, post it into Microsoft Word. Convert that text, highlight the whole posting, and convert it into a table so that you can have, now you can establish separate columns. Adjacent to each responsibility, type your notes. And in those notes, that's where you extract your questions so that you can talk to these people to get the answers you need to make a decision as to whether or not this place is really for you. Will it fit you? Also, forget about the extrinsic benefits. If you go there, they owe you the extrinsic benefits. They're going to pay you. They're going to give you health care, more than likely. You're going to get days off. So the extrinsic benefits are there. Try to identify the intrinsic benefits. How much fulfillment, personal fulfillment, are you going to get out of that job? How much joy
yes.
going to get out of that job? How much is it going to help grow as a person? And how much is it going to help you to grow as a professional? Look at the intrinsic benefits and begin to compare. What if you get three different offers from three different places? Do you have a process in place to evaluate which one is the best fit? Which one represented themselves in a more transparent fashion? Yes, you must evaluate transparency of organizations during that process, and a lot of companies are not.
So where is this matrix? How do you get it? Where is this little calculator that you can put into a document and quickly see whether a company is good for you or not? How do you evaluate this? Don't worry. We got you covered. In the show notes, there's going to be a link. You can grab the document there yourself. You could just fill it out. You'll put, it's a matrix essentially. So on one side, you'll put the different requirements. On the other side, you'll put whether you have those or not. And over the course of filling out the worksheet, you should end up with a score. And you should be able to clearly determine whether you should pursue the job or not. So good advice from Darren. Don't just haphazardly apply to any place. Make sure that you're considering every possible thing you can. Make sure you research and vet them heavily. So thank you so much for listening today. We talked with Darren Hood. He had a ton of amazing information to go over. I'm splitting this episode up into part one and part two. This was part one. I'm going to bring Darren back, I promise. We're going to talk about a bunch of cool things. By the way, if you liked listening to Darren, let us know. Send us an email. You can reach us at info@thirdlayer.io. Tell us what you think. Tell us how you like the show. And if you're looking to join us on the show, send us an email there too. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jonathan Bowman. You've been listening to Diagram.